This is the official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Hello, everybody. Welcome along to the official EFL podcast with me, Mark Clement. It may be the international break with no forthcoming fixtures in the Sky Bet Championship and half of Sky Bet League One, but we've still got plenty to chew over. Derby County are up for sale. Gary Monk is down the river and Southend United's chairman would like to paddle several of his players downstream with him. It's the official EFL podcast. Wherever his travels have taken him, he's never made any secret of his love for QPR. His football journey has taken him from the non-leagues to the Premier League via the World Cup. But did you know that however successful Albert Adoma has been with his feet, he's always had his level 2 decorative finishing and industrial painting qualification to fall back on. And I can see him and he's laughing. So you'd never have guessed this was going to be my first question for you, Albert. College of North West London, playing for Harrow Borough in the Isthmian League. When was the last time you picked up a paintbrush?
Funny enough, not long ago, during the lockdown. That's the last time I picked up a paintbrush because my first house, I actually decorated it myself. Believe it or not, instead of getting a painter in, I ripped off all the wallpaper and I thought I'd put a lining paper, paint everything in the house all by myself. So I saved myself about $4,000.
Wow. But that was your first house, but you also did it again during lockdown.
And I also do it. Well, I also done painting during the lockdown because obviously just to keep myself busy, just touch up little scrap marks off the wall, you know. You got children nowadays, they're always messy, you know, messing up the play. So you have to tidy up after them.
We got you on here to talk about your love for QPR, but nah. I feel like as we're in a second lockdown, I might get you to do some paint recommendations for easy wipe and all that stuff. Do you find it therapeutic? Do you find it like it relaxes you doing it?
I think it's just because it's something that I've learned as a trade, you know. So if you can do it yourself, why not? Even putting up wallpaper for my wife and her study room was amazing, you know. I just got that buzz about just making something look good, you know. It's like an art, really, doing painting and just a finished article. You know, when it all comes together, it's just an amazing feeling.
I tell you what, mate, I've got a few jobs need doing here. I'm just wondering if you know, it's international break now as we're talking to. I'm just wondering if you could get you around and get the bathroom sorted out for me.
No problem. I charge £10 an hour. You know, that's the cheapest rate going.
Tell me something. What would Albert Adoma back then, who's still to fully get into his football career and get on that journey that you've been on, what would he think about Albert Adoma and the career he's had up to this point now?
I mean, that's very interesting to say, you know, going back in time, you know, what would I think now? And I think going back in time, I never thought that I'll be a footballer, believe it or not, you know, even when I was doing painting and decorating, you know, doing apprenticeship, especially for my one of my old bosses, you know, waking up 6 a.m. in the morning, standing on the side road, getting picked up because at the time I didn't drive. I was only 17, 18. So waking up early as a young boy, sometimes the boss has to call me to wake me up. I'm like, I'm up, boss. I'm just running down the stairs. But obviously I was still half asleep. So I had to rush downstairs and get picked up, go to work for 9 and then finish about 5. And then sometimes when I have a break, then obviously I can sort of relax. If not, if I have training after painting, sometimes I had to ask permission from my boss to obviously go training and then play for Harrow Borough, you know, at the time. So I think at the time, I didn't really think that I'll be a footballer till the later stage of my Harrow Borough career when I knew Dagenham was like interested in me. That's why I thought, oh, maybe I'll be a professional footballer. So I was still young, just 19 turning 20 at the time, and I remember when the interest came in for Dagenham, that's where I thought, yes, I could be a professional footballer. And funny enough, I actually turned down Dagenham and Redbridge, believe it or not, before I signed for Barnet. So I thought maybe my professional career was finished, you know, by turning down a club.
I mean, would that have been enough for you if your career had turned out to be playing semi-professional but had your other trade and things, would you have still been happy in life, or do you think you'd have had that kind of niggle that there was that unfulfilled part of you?
I mean, it's obviously easy to say it now, but I think at the time, from the background that I grew up, my mum was a teacher, my grandma was a teacher, deaf teacher, so for me, it's always about education, you know, study well and do well. And that's the path I try to follow in a way. Obviously, I've done painting and decorating. It's more about schoolwork, college work, and then university. But I was very fortunate that I became a professional before I stepped into the university camp. Because for me, I really wanted to be a fireman when I was younger, because I always wanted to help people, rescue people. And when you watch films, it's like, wow. You know, the things that they do to save people, it's like life at risk, but they're very passionate about something like that. And that's something that I wanted to do as a youngster, you know, be a fireman. So I think maybe I'd have probably worked towards that. Maybe if that didn't work out, then maybe an athlete, because I was very talented at sports. So maybe in that path. But I think, like I said before, I was very, very passionate that I'm very fortunate that my football turned out to be, you know, where it has been at the moment, or how it's still going. I was very fortunate that I'm still following my football career at the moment.
This interview is getting better and better. It's got depths and subjects I never thought we'd be going into. The fire service. I've already sorted out my little problem with that bathroom. It's getting better and better. Was there ever any point when you were a youngster where you might have got on QPR's books at that moment, rather than having to wait towards the back end of your career?
I'll be honest with you, because when I started following QPR, I think I was about 14, 15, so the early 2000s, sort of 2003, 2004. And obviously, I used to play football next to the stadium, Loftus Road Stadium at the time. And literally, there's a pitch that we used to call the rubber, because the turf of it was like rubber. So every time we play, it used to flip up and down, you know. And I used to walk past the stadium, and I thought, you know what, it'll be amazing one day to play inside the stadium. I wasn't even thinking at the time as a supporter playing for the club. So I was just thinking, oh, it'd be nice playing professional football in this stadium or playing against QPR, you know. And obviously, in my path, I never played for any academy. So I never thought I'll be playing for QPR Academy. I was more playing park football, street football, you name it, five-a-side football, even Sunday football, you know. And that's the path I had to follow: amateur football, amateur and combination football, and then semi-professional football. So passing the stadium sort of woke me up in a way, you know. It's more like you picture something and it sort of gradually it's about to happen and it doesn't happen. And I think I remember, Mark, when I was at Middlesbrough, I had a little bit of a up and down with the manager, and I think you probably know the manager, Karanka, at the time,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
and when that mishap happened with Karanka, I think that's when QPR was interested in me. So I thought, wow, this might be my opportunity now, you know, because funny enough, the transfer window was open and I thought, oh, maybe I could get a cheeky move to a team that I support. But at the time, no one really knew I supported QPR. But I thought, yes, this is going to happen. And there was an interest in me, but I think they had to buy me. But due to financial reasons, it didn't happen. So that's like nearly 6 years ago, probably. And then when I went Villa, I think I had my last season. They nearly came in for me. But once again, it was due to financial reasons. And then now it just happened when I didn't expect it, funny enough. It happened because I thought I was going to go Cardiff this season, because I went Cardiff on loan last season. I'd done really well. I went back to Forest. And when my agent rang me saying, oh, Albert, guess what team is interested in you? I thought, oh, Cardiff. Listen, Albert, don't be silly. It's a London team. So once he said that, I thought, no way. I just said to him, just make it happen. And that was it. You know, that was it. You know, never look back.
Mate. That's just fantastic. It's just
amazing. It's amazing.
It really is. It really is. So it kind of begs the question, and I'll be honest with you, I haven't been back through your career and looked at all the times you've played against QPR when you were playing for Bristol City and Borough and Forest and Villa, etc., and Cardiff. But how did you feel when you actually had to turn out against them?
You know what? It was strange, because when I was actually living in West London, at Harrow Borough, our pre-season games was against QPR. And obviously, they used to destroy us all the time. But people don't remember that because it's semi-pro. But for us, that was like one of the biggest games, because we're playing against a Premiership team or a Championship team at the time. So for me, it was like, wow, I'm playing against QPR. This is the team. But then people didn't know, because at the time, I used to tell people I support United, obviously Glory Hunter. Early 1990s and early 2000s, you know, every child would go for the team that wins the league, you know. So that was me. But I was thinking, wow, QPR players, I can't wait to play for them, you know. And obviously that was like our pre-season highlight, the biggest game in semi-professional for Haribara, you know. And it was just an amazing feeling. And then obviously when I became a professional playing for Bristol City, playing against QPR, I was like, wow. And then playing against them, Middlesbrough. I think I played against QPR about 10 times in my career, and I happened to score two past them at Loftus Road at the time, and I didn't even celebrate. You know, I didn't celebrate, you know. So, you know, because I knew that one day maybe I might play for them, and it happened, you know. And it was strange. I actually got a story to tell you, Mark. Go when on, I was at Middlesbrough, I think it was the 2014 season, I believe, we played against QPR and we lost 1-0. So after the game, you know, like the usual procedure, players shake hands and walk off, oh, well done, all the best. I went to the tunnel and I just waited there. And every QPR player that came past, I'm like, can I have your top? Can I have your top? I think I made a record collecting 7 tops, you know, after the game, after a defeat. And you know, our skipper at the time was Grant Lebiter. He probably told you this. We went to the changing room, said, Albert, what the... are you doing collecting tops? We just lost 1-0. I'm like, skip. I was speechless. I just skip. So you were shouting at me, but I didn't have no words to say back to him. I went skip. And I just put my head down. And I think Tony Mowbray just spoke after that. And I just thought, why is he shouting at me? It's only tops. You know, but I don't think they knew that I supported QPR. You know, yeah. So I collected about 7 tops after a game. So I don't think any other player has done that before.
I always am intrigued by these situations. And there's a very famous one way, way back in history in the mid-70s where Dennis Law sent his beloved Manchester United down to the second division when he was playing for Man City with this cheeky, nonchalant back heel. And he actually relegated Man United, which has got to be... it's got to be the ultimate sort of contrast in what you're feeling inside between loyalty to your current employers, yeah, but your loyalty in the past. So there was never a moment when you played against them where you actually could have inflicted proper damage, potentially relegated them or anything like that?
Never a moment. But there's times where obviously I made jokes when people start, when my teammates started to know that I support QPR, because I always used to make jokes like, I'll be playing for QPR as the best team in the championship, even when they weren't doing well. And I said, watch when we play, I'm going to score on goal. But obviously I was joking at the time, you know, so that's the only thing that I come closest to, just by joking, saying I'm going to score on goal when we play against QPR at the time. And I said, you can't do that. I'm like, I'm just joking. I'm not actually going to do that, am I? You know, so yeah.
So let me take you to Bournemouth on the 17th of October. You're starting to warm up. You're getting stripped off in the 60th minute. The 67th's coming. And then you step over that line with that badge on your chest for the first time. Go on, what are you feeling?
What the feeling, believe it or not, was like, wow. You know, that's the expression. Even on my social media platform, Twitter and Insta, I posted a picture of me coming on as a sub, and literally I just put the caption, wow. You know, there's no words can't describe it. And I think that was the moment I knew that I'm a QPR player. You know, all my friends that support QPR, most of my friends because they're from West London that support QPR, was messaging me. Even some of my old friends that I haven't spoken to for years was messaging me on media, everything, you know. And I'm like, wow, this is the moment. You know, every child or every young boy that has played around that area in White City wanted to play for the local team. I made it possible. And I think one of my interviews, I said, look, this is possible. It's possible for the local boys, you know. So sometimes you just have to have faith and hope that you can actually play for your local team. I know obviously there's modern football, teams tend to scout players abroad and whatnot, but I still believe it's possible for me to do it at this age, 32, playing for my local club. Obviously, I wanted this to be early on in my future, but for it to happen later on, it shows that it's possible. It doesn't matter what age, if you're still determined or focused, it can happen. And when it happened against Bournemouth, that's where I thought, yes, wow, this is the best feeling, you know. And funny enough, everyone thought my first touch I was going to score, but I didn't touch it because the defender cleared it off the line, sort of. So that would have been the dream story, but my first touch was actually me kicking the ball off the pitch. But no one actually remembers that, but I remember that, you know. So it's a funny story, you know, but that's the moment, you know. It's crazy.
Oh, but can I share with you that I think, I mean, I've been in this industry now for coming up to 25 years. I don't think I have ever heard a footballer talk with as much passion for the team that he's playing for as you have over the last 10 minutes that we've been chatting. It's remarkable. You absolutely love that football club.
Listen, Mark, even like I say, it's a team that I support, you know, as a local boy, you know, that's my team. I could have chose Brentford. I could have chose Fulham. I could have followed my brother's footsteps following Chelsea. But I thought I had to support a team. And even at the time when I was sort of supporting my United, Glory Hunter, you know, it was more like I need a local team. And I thought, yeah, some of my friends support QPR. And I thought, yeah, I'm going to support QPR because I can play for them one day because my United is too far from me. So why not support a local team? And I think, obviously, I'll be passionate because it's a team that I support and I want the team to do well, you know. So I think that's the reason why, because I can join a club and say, yeah, I'm happy to be here. I'm happy for the challenge. And that's the standard procedure. Every club that I've been at, it's the same. And I think the only one that, not being disrespectful, obviously, I was happy that I played for other clubs in my career. But if you check my interviews, yes, I was excited to be there at the time. But it's not the same feeling, you know. I think the only feeling that come closer is probably when I signed for Barnet, you know, being professional footballer. That's like one of my highlight career in my career. Not even promotion, me becoming a professional, signing for Barnet was like, wow, I'm actually a professional footballer. I'm not going to do painting and decorating now. It's literally just football. My hobby is turned into work. It's turned into a career now. So that's why I thought, yes, I've made it, but I still had to work to get to the top, if that makes sense, Mark.
It definitely makes sense. But then if that was a real high, signing for Barnet, how did it feel when the painter and decorator ended up going to the World Cup in Brazil with Ghana in 2014? I mean, goodness me.
I mean, representing your national team is always a pleasure, you know. Every player dreams to play for. And if you're a professional footballer, you always dream or you always picture, say, to be to play for your national team. If you have the opportunity to play for your national team.
Can I just check with you? I mean,
yes.
So was the link through mum or dad or both?
No, both. Both parents are from Ghana, West Africa, for those that
okay.
don't know.
Okay, so do you know the country well? Are you often travelling
yes.
back there to meet wider family and all the rest of it?
Oh, I can go through my whole history, but I don't want to go because I'm going to break quick history. I'm going to break this down.
No, go for it. I want to hear it. I want to hear this.
So I was born in the UK, Lambeth, London, Southwest London. And at the age of, say, one, my parents decided to send me back home, you know, so I can learn the cool traditional route. Because that's what African parents tend to do. So when you're born here, they send you back home. So you sort of learn the culture, you know, the language, so I could speak the language fluent now, you know. English was supposed to be my first language because I was born here, but that wasn't the case. I was sent back home to Ghana, West Africa, age of one to age of nine. So when I was 10, then I sort of came back here and then started primary school here to start all over again, learning English and obviously learning the English way, you know. So even though I'm a British boy, I always say I'm African. You know, so because I grew up in Africa first, you know, even though I was born.
Because I'm always intrigued with those squads, whether there's a conflict between the sort of homegrown players and the ones that maybe have more distant sort of links to the homeland. I'm always wondering if there's a conflict within squads. Although I guess most West African players now are plying their trade outside of Africa, aren't they? I suppose there's not that many. I mean, what's the standard like in Ghana these days with the sort of domestic football?
I mean, the league is good because I don't know if you know Asamoah Gyan. I know he's older now.
Yeah, yeah.
And he used to play for Sunderland, you know. And
him,
he's back home now because obviously he's been abroad and he's back playing in the Ghana league. Because now if he's playing, because he's well known, it will sort of attract other players, you know, other foreign players, I'll say, to the Ghana league. And I think it's a good league, but it's not well known. But I guess they need a few more known players, then people can sort of go there, you know. And that's where some managers go there to apply their trade and then move on. Yeah. But for me being a British Ghanaian, I'll say, it's easier because I can speak the language when I go to the national team. And believe it or not, Mark, when you go to the national team, because there's so many players playing in different countries, they don't even speak Twi, which was the main Ghanaian language. They all speak Spanish, Italian, German. So sometimes you're sitting on the table thinking, are you Ghanaian or are you Italian? Are you Spanish? You know, so that's the beauty of it, you know, because just learning other language, you know, and it's an easy thing. And obviously, if you're from back home, Ghana, and you make it into the national team, it's more of a, I don't know, it's just like a icing on the cake in a way, because it's sort of like they develop you from the local league and they're pushing you to the national team. And I think obviously the supporters, the home supporters will more encourage you more or push you more. Whereas if you're from Europe, it's like you sort of made it already, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that's the difference. But going to the World Cup with the national league, with the national team was just amazing feeling. I never thought I'd make the World Cup squad because at the time, I think I was at Middlesbrough, You know, and I think I'd done well for Middlesbrough because I think one season I finished top scorer. I think it was that same season where I finished top scorer, and obviously I got called up and I thought I'm not even going to make the 30-man squad for Ghana because there's so much players, too many players, and they're playing at a top level as well. And when I made the cut, it was like, wow, I made it. I'm actually going to the World Cup. And in my head, I was thinking, there's World Cup, there's world-class players like Ibrahimovic, Ryan Giggs that hasn't even played World Cup. Yes, they won leagues, they won everything, but they haven't played World Cup, you know. And I used to make jokes with, Ibrahimovic done this. Yeah, Giggs done this, played Premiership for 20 years, but has he played World Cup? No, I played non-league, but I played World Cup, you know. So that's the jokes I used to make, you know. So it's just a little joke. I know obviously they've won honours and that, and everyone see that, but I've mingled with the best of the best, and that's an amazing feeling. And just to even step on the World Cup field, I only played 15 minutes against USA. We lost 2-1, but just to be in the light and the group as USA, Germany and Portugal was the group of death, and the winners were Germany. And I think we drew against Germany. So that says a lot, you know.
I love your story. I love your story. Final question. 3 wins out of 11 so far. We're just about the quarterway point of the season. Now, are you going to answer this question from the perspective of a QPR player, or are you going to answer it from the perspective of a QPR fan? I'll let you decide. What is a realistic aim for the club this season?
I'll be honest with you, Mark. For me, obviously, as a player, you know, forget supporter. As a player, every club that I've been at, I want to do well for the club. And I always see that the Championship is one of the difficult leagues. And I always say, with the Championship, you always have 2 opportunities to get promotion. It doesn't matter what team you are, because you all start from zero. And if you don't get automatic promotion, the beauty of the Championship, you have playoffs. So that's the 2 opportunities there. And last season, I nearly had 4 opportunities because I was at Forest and I was at Cardiff. Both teams made it into the playoff, but unfortunately, Forest dropped out and then Cardiff lost. So that's the first time I had 4 opportunities. But with every team, when you start from fresh, you have 2 opportunities. And I believe that QPR, me being here as well, can help the team. I'm not saying I'm here to save the team, but I know as a player, I can help the team. And I believe that with Mark Warburton in charge as well, the style of football that we're playing, I believe that we can reach top 6 easily. I know I could say we can win the league, but there's always favourite in every league or every sport. And it's obviously Bournemouth, Watford and Norwich, because they just got relegated from the Premiership. So they'll be the favourites to go straight up. But I believe any team can push for the top 6. If you don't do automatic, you got the playoffs. So that's the beauty of the Championship. And I believe QPR can do it this season. If not, that's another season. But I hope that it's whilst I'm here, we get the promotion, which will be amazing. That will be icing on the cake for me. You know, the team that I love getting promotion with them, that will be a beauty thing.
Uncle Albert, I have to say, this has been one of my most enjoyable interviews I have ever done. I love your story. Well done, finally getting to QPR. Thanks for joining us on the EFL podcast.
Oh, thank you very much, Mark. Thank you.
The official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
I am blessed, I am fortunate, I am very lucky. I get to talk Sky Bet Championship, League One, League Two every week on the official EFL podcast. And very occasionally, producer Dave calls off the dogs and allows me a small hand in choosing our guests. And with the greatest of respect to all the other fine people who've graced the podcast this season, top of my list since we got underway in mid-September has been that girl who used to play football, one of England's most capped women's players, and BBC Quest and Sky Sports pundit, Sue Smith. And here's my first question for you, Sue. Are you a former player turned pundit, or are you now a pundit who used to play football?
Oh, that's a good question and a very good introduction. I'll pay you for that later.
Thank you.
But yeah, I've got to say, a former player turned pundit. I think that's the way. I've never officially retired, Clem. I still held out for that 100th cap. Got 93 and didn't quite make the 100th. So thought still got my boots there waiting. But I think when you turn 40, I don't think the call's coming.
Well, I don't know. Let's just see what happens in the next few years. But I was paying you the compliment that I absolutely love hearing you and watching. Obviously, we worked together a little bit at the BBC before you went off to the dark side and spent most of your Saturdays working for Sky on Soccer Saturday. But your energy and effervescence, it's a sorely lacking trait, in my opinion, in football. You're just
Do you
fret about it? Do you worry about it? I mean, how much of a challenge has it been for you? Because you look like an absolute natural to me.
Oh, I do get nervous. And I was like that all the way through my football career. Before every game, I got nervous. And I just think, again, taking stuff from my football career through to my sort of work on the TV, it's just as long as you're fully prepared and you feel like you've done all of your prep. So with football, you've done all of your training, you've made sure that your nutrition and your diet is absolutely spot on. You're ready for that game on the Sunday. And exactly the same with doing games. You try to know what you're talking about. But yeah, I still get nervous, but I love it. I really, really enjoy what I'm doing. You can't really call it a job, going out watching football, whether it's in the studio or whether it's actually at the ground. It's something that I couldn't have dreamed of. So I really enjoy it.
I have to ask you about Soccer Saturday, because on face value, I think what you've done, which has become a regular studio pundit, feels like it might have been a challenge, quite a long established array of people that are involved going way, way back. I mean, has that transition, do you think, been easy? I'm sure you're going to say they've made you feel welcome, but you know what I'm saying? It's quite an environment to have to walk into. You must have been bricking it the first time, weren't you?
I absolutely was. And I think one of my first shows, it was a midweek soccer special. And I remember they sent through the guests that I was with, and it was Phil Thompson, it was Paul Merson, and it was Charlie Nicholas. And I was like, oh my gosh, these are the three that have been doing it for years. They're absolutely brilliant in what they do. And I was more nervous about, I think, the chat beforehand because of the experiences that they had. And I was thinking, will they want to know my opinion? Will they be bothered about it? And when I actually got into doing the game, I was fine because it was just, it was just football. It was just talking about what I was seeing. So I was a little bit more comfortable with that. But yeah, they've been absolutely brilliant with me. They've made me feel, so at home. And Phil Thompson, obviously, I'm a blue and he's a red, but he sort of helped me so much with, when I went in there first day, had my, my teams all set out, and he came over and he asked, was I okay? And did I need any help? And so, yeah, they've all been great, but yeah, it's always difficult. I think when you're a female going into a men's environment, I felt that with Final Score when I used to go into the grounds and you'd look around the media room and it is full of men, but it's slowly getting there where it's a mix now, and I think it's just if you're good enough, then it shouldn't really matter.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's moving very fast as well, isn't it? I mean, hey, you're the one with the insights as to what sort of treatment you get, but you'd have to be an absolute dinosaur now to draw a distinction on gender, surely. You're just somebody that talks brilliantly about football.
Yeah, and I think it's, like I say, I enjoy watching football, and hopefully that comes across. And yeah, I think opinions and perceptions that are definitely changing. I think a lot of it was, you're a female footballer, so how can you talk about men's football? But it is just football, in my opinion. And you see, I quite like the balance between, you know, men talking about men's football, women talking about men's football, and vice versa. I think, you know, sometimes we maybe see different things, and I like that. And you know, hopefully other people do as well.
Fantastic. Well, listen, I've got the championship table in front of me. We're just about at the quarterway point. Reading are still top, but dropped 2 points from the first 24. And then they've lost three in a row. No goals scored, six conceded at home in the last week alone. I mean, I guess the crucial question is, when does a blip become inset form?
I think, Clem, because there's so many games in such a short period of time, that I think if you go through a bad moment or a blip in form, it could last two or three games, couldn't it? And I was actually really surprised to see Reading's last three results, the amount of goals conceded, because the couple of games that I watched them play, that was the strength, you know, that they were defensively, they were very solid and they were very well organised, very much defended as a team. They had those, you know, the two holding mids of Rinomota and Lauren just in front of the back four, and they pretty much protected that defence. And then you had the experience, Moore and Morrison at centre-back. I know Moore hasn't played in the last couple, which I'm sure is a huge loss for them.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, really, can one player so much dictate the shape, the form, the solidity of a team?
Yeah, I think when you've got a solid back four goalkeeper holding two mids and that's your, you know, what you're building your team around, making sure that you're defensively solid. Because I watched them against Blackburn and they won 4-2. They only had four shots on target and scored four goals. So it was pretty much making sure, I know they conceded two goals there, but making sure that we don't concede too many goals. And when we get our chances, we take them and we're clinical, because I know they've had no Ajarie, they've had no Mate. So I suppose you're looking at key players that are missing. Does really affect that balance. But yeah, I just think the fact that there's so many games in such a short space of time, that if you are having that little blip, it sort of seems a little bit worse, because you think, well, last three results have been pretty poor. But actually, that could have only been in the last week. So yeah, I'm sure they'll come through that. I'm sure once they get their players back fit, they'll get back to the form that we've seen early on.
So to that end, Bristol City, who won their first four, best start since the late 1920s, then didn't get a win in five, to go back and win their last two, I mean, that will be an immense amount of relief to them. Because I guess what happens is, when you do have a good start, you raise expectations even further than they were before the campaign gets underway.
Yeah, and I think sometimes that can maybe be the problem, because your expectations then are so high, the fans start believing, and then suddenly you have a little dip in form, whether that is due to an injured player or whether that's, I don't know, maybe a little bit of fatigue or players carrying little niggles that we don't always know about. So it's always nice then to get that positive result, especially when there's a little break coming up as well. You want to go into that break with a positive result. But yeah, when you set the expectations so high, you know, speaking to Reading fans, they're sort of, at the start of the season, they were like, wow, we're going to go and win the league here. You know, they actually had that belief, and then a few little results then maybe knocked them. So yeah, it's positive that Bristol City have been able to change that around.
And then when I look at the sort of makeup of that top six, Watford in second going into the international break, Norwich in third, Bournemouth in fourth. And I mean, it's ominous, isn't it? And yet I don't feel that any of the three of them have truly got into their total stride yet, Sue.
Yeah, I've got to agree. And again, you've watched some games where you've thought, yeah, you can see that they have those quality players. They have the quality from the Premier League. But then you've watched other games where you thought they've not really got into their stride. I think that's a really good way of putting it. You know, I suppose looking at Bournemouth, I think it was they've what got up into fourth, haven't they? And it was their second win in seven. So I think sometimes it's always difficult when a new manager comes in and takes over, because Eddie Howe was, he was Mr. Bournemouth for so long, wasn't he? So I suppose adapting to that new manager. But again, watching Bournemouth, there's been times where I've seen them get into good positions and they've just not quite found the back of the net, or they've not quite found that clinical pass. But against Birmingham, I thought that's exactly what they did. Brooks, as we know, is a great player. We've seen that in the Premier League. It's just, I suppose, a case of making sure he stays fit, because I know he might be injured again, hopefully not. But they've certainly got the players, have Bournemouth. And then similar, you can talk about Watford, the experienced players that they've got in, it's like Cleverley, Foster, you've got Troy Deeney. And I was actually really impressed with James Garner, who's only, he's only 19. But against Coventry, I thought he was brilliant. So again, they've got that mix of youth and experience. And then I suppose Norwich are probably the ones that are enjoying that rich vein of form, if you like, and a good win against Swansea, as we know, are doing well themselves.
But I got their stats here. I mean, and I think maybe there was all that attention on Watford and how many players might leave, and then ditto with Bournemouth, would Josh King go? And obviously they did have two or three high profiles. I know Norwich got rid of a few, but they were kind of probably the least talked about pre-season. But get this, 12 points gained in goals in the final 10 minutes of matches. So that is seven of their 11 games they have scored late goals in that have improved their points tally, which was a characteristic the season before last when they went up so mercurially as well. I mean, that's a good indicator, isn't it?
Well, they will certainly look at that, and I'm sure that will be a stat that they'll be showing the team. But that's got to say that fitness wise as well, when you're coming into a game in the last 10 minutes and winning games in those last few moments, that you have that fitness to be able to go for 90 minutes plus, and I suppose it's also to have that belief that you can do that. They've got the creative players in Buendia. Again, we've seen flashes of that in the Premier League. And I just think if Pukki can keep scoring on a consistent basis, that they're certainly going to create chances for him. So I think they've certainly got enough. The problem last season, we spoke about so many times, didn't we, was the amount of clean sheets. They just couldn't keep clean sheets. Defensively, they were very poor, and yet they went and got another clean sheet at the weekend. So that's going to be something I think that they need to make sure that they focus on, that because we know that they've got the quality going forward.
Yeah, they've introduced Ben Gibson on loan from Burnley in their mm-hmm. back four. Ben Gibson's uncle owns Middlesbrough. See what I've done here, Sue? Middlesbrough are unbeaten in 10. Oh, why don't you just love it when a link seegs across majestically like that? Listen, I mean, how much does being hard to beat sort of underpin everything?
It's certainly a very good starting point, isn't it? You look at the very best sides, they're built on a solid defensive unit, I suppose, and that's exactly what Borough have done. They just defend so well as a team from front to back. It's not just the defenders, it's the whole of the team. And you just feel that all of the players know their roles and responsibilities, what's expected of them. And I know managers talk a lot about this, but it's about being good without the ball. And I think that's exactly what Borough have done. So as soon as they lose the ball, they get into such a good shape and they make it difficult for teams to break them down. So yeah, I think Warnock's done a great job in making them a real difficult side to play against.
So in League One, we've got leaders Peterborough at Crewe. Peterborough lost two of their first three, but have won seven of their last eight. Hull are at home to Burton. Sunderland, who lost to Mansfield Town, obviously from a division lower, are at home to MK Dons. And then on Monday night, we've got, well, some people don't like it when we use the phrase Dockyard Derby, but I'm going to do it anyway. Eighth place Plymouth, entertaining seventh place Portsmouth. In League Two, then, no Newport County game this weekend. Their game at Grimsby called off due to international call-ups. Richie Wellens takes his league bow as Salford manager against Bolton. It's 5v6 as Carlisle play Cheltenham. Nigel Clough's tenure as Mansfield Town boss starts at Forest Green Rovers. He was in attendance and watching as they beat Sunderland in the cup. I kind of look at this and I quite admire Nigel for picking and choosing opportunities that work for him and his lifestyle. If you look at his appointments, and he kind of lives still in the, I think, in the Derby sort of area, you know, Sheffield United, commutable, obviously been at Burton a couple of times. I kind of looked at that and thought, really? Is he going to go for that? But maybe that mix works. Do you admire him for sort of being quite principled like that and not being willing to tear things up and just travel hundreds of miles away?
Yeah, I do. It clearly fits in with his lifestyle and what he wants. And you just feel that Mansfield Town, maybe they've lost their way a little bit, haven't they, in recent years. So I suppose he'll be hoping that he can maybe turn that around. And we know that he is he's meticulous in his planning, and he'll certainly have a clear plan. He'll want to make sure that the team have an identity. I'm sure the fans will be hoping he'll play attacking football, but with a structure. And you just think he's certainly going to get the respect instantly when he goes into the dressing room. So, yeah, I do admire him, and I think it's a challenge for him, but I'm sure it's one that he's quite prepared to take, and he'll believe that he can do.
Brace yourself, Sue. Here comes another one of my flexible bendy links. So Mansfield without a win, and so too Southend United. In fact, Southend have taken just 2 points from a possible 33. In fact, since the start of last season, curtailed of course, they've taken just 4 league wins from 46. So the equivalent of an entire season, 4 league wins from 46. Ron Martin there, owner, chairman, said this week after their cup defeat to Boreham Wood, some of our players are not good enough and some don't work hard enough. If you were Mark Molesley, the manager, how helpful would that be?
Oh, it's just the last thing that you want to hear. You don't need that at all. You think you're in a difficult moment anyway. So for the chairman to come out and say that, and that's, as a player, when somebody says that you don't work hard, that's horrible, because that's a given. You know, when you go out onto the field, it's a given that you work hard for your team.
Well, wait a second, Sue. Let me play devil's advocate then. Let's say I own a factory. Let's say I own a factory and I employ you, and the deal is you've got to, I'm just looking around me for something you could possibly make. The deal is you've got to spin me 20 mugs an hour on a spinning wheel, right? Let's say I run a craft pottery business. I've just thought this up, folks. I don't know where it's come from. But let's say everybody else in the studio is turning out 20 plus mugs an hour. But Sue Smith starts to work for me, and because she's so chatty, she's constantly looking across at other people. Occasionally she's checking her phone. She takes more toilet breaks than anybody else, and she only turns out 16. Am I not entitled to come to you and say, Sue, you're not working hard enough. Everybody else is doing 20 mugs plus an hour. You're only doing 16.
I see that. And I think that's a really good point and a valid point made, Clem. But I think what I would like you to do is come to me personally and tell me that. So say, stop chatting, on your phone, stop going on the toilet breaks, but don't tell everybody. So don't go to the whole room and tell everybody that I'm not working hard enough, so I think go to the manager and say that to him, go to the players individually if that's what you believe, but don't come out in the press and say that, because I just don't think that's very helpful, and just then causes a divide between the manager and the players and the backroom staff. So I feel for them, because I know that they're fighting for the future, aren't they, on and off the field. And
no, you make a good point, Sue, actually, because we had the whole Ian Evatt and Billy Crellin thing, didn't we, a few weeks ago, when Ian Evatt criticised his on-loan goalkeeper quite publicly. And actually, I had a conversation with a long-established golf course coach called Dennis Pugh this week, who's been with Monty and for a very short period, Seve Ballesteros. He's currently with Francesco Molinari. And he was saying he works a three-tier system. So when it's very severe criticism, it's a whisper in the player's ear. If it's if it's milder, he'll step back into what he calls zone two, and if it's full-scale praise, then he'll come into zone three and make it very public. So that's his method of administering criticism or praise, and it kind of makes sense. So
it does, and I think people go about things different way, don't they? People manage people, players, different ways. And I think the most important part of being a manager is knowing your players and knowing what works for them. Because I remember last season, I think it was when, was it last season or the season before, when Chris Wilder spoke about the goalkeeper Henderson when he'd made that mistake against Liverpool. And he came out into the press and straight away said that it was a mistake, it was poor. And I was a bit like, oh, I wouldn't have done that. I'd have just spoke to the player individually. And I didn't really like that he'd done that. But he knew his player, because the next week, Henderson went and got man of the match. So it shows that if you know your players and you know what works for them, it's the right thing to do. But I'm just not a massive fan. I'm very much tell me individually, and I'll try and work on that to go publicly. Just don't think that helps anybody.
You see, this is a message to producer Dave. What a great idea of mine it was to get Sue Smith on this week's official EFL podcast. I've had a blast. Lovely to talk to you.
Oh, and you as well. Great to chat.
That's it for this week. A massive thanks to Sue Smith and to Albert Adoma. If you've enjoyed this week's episode, then feel free to give us a 5-star rating. Press the subscribe button and please share on your socials. If you'd like to get in touch, our email address is podcast@efl.com. That's podcast@efl.com. My name's Mark Clement. Thanks very much for listening. We'll see you next week for another episode of
the official EFL podcast.